Okay, so Penny's talk, reuse, recycle, revolt. Why tokenism is not a class act?
Well, thank you very much. First of all, before anything, it's great to see Danny back in action. Hello, everybody.
Yeah.
Nice to see you, mate.
Thank you.
When I was asked to do this, it reminded me of the very first talk I ever did in the Socialist Party. It was back in 1983. It was on climate. It was on pollution. And I didn't know anything then. I had no experience, so I put too much material in, and it went on for 3 hours and everyone fell asleep. So I'm not going to do that again. But the reason I remembered it was because there were certain resonances that occurred to me when I was looking at this subject right back then. So what I want to do is do a little bit of a history thing, starting with... Oh, this is a guy sat on top of a plane, by the way. You know, this is like a sort of token gesture to stop a load of people going on holiday, I guess. This is kind of where it started, people, Rachel Carson, 1963, or for Silent Spring. This was really the end of the sort of modernist period of optimism, where we can make everything bigger, faster, cheaper, shinier, cover it in chrome, and that's the future for us all. And this book pointed out the downside, the environmental downside of all this, the pollution, the toxic rivers, the pesticide runoff, this sort of thing. And it was called Silent Spring because she had a friend who had a piece of land with a spring on it, and it was completely silent because all the birds were dead, and they were dead because of DDT poisoning. So, weirdly, Rachel Carson actually died in 1964, and she's still attacked today by right-wing sort of, you know, haters who blame her for millions of malaria deaths around the world. They say she caused that. It's complete nonsense. DDT was never banned for use against mosquitoes. It just stopped working. So go back to something that Bill was saying earlier about, you know, bogus arguments people come up with. What was it that Rachel Carson did? David Attenborough called this book the one that changed science, the one that changed the scientific world the most after Origin of Species. What was it that she did that was so special? Because, after all, everybody knew about pollution already. We had the smogs, London and Manchester. One particular one in 1952, 12,000 people are thought to have died during that one smog. So, and of course, we've got smogs today in... Right across China, Delhi, you can barely see your hand in front of your face in some of the smogs in Delhi today, apparently. So, you know, it's not that we didn't know about pollution. What was it that Carson did? I think she established a powerful narrative of the corporation versus the citizen, or what in modern parlance we might call the military-industrial complex versus the private individual. Now, my earlier talk went on to discuss some examples of this, and we were talking about people's heroes. Here's one of my personal heroes. This is Karen Silkwood, who was almost certainly murdered by the Kerr-McGee Corporation for whistleblowing the fact that they were drawing over X-rays of cracked fuel rods for nuclear power stations with black felt pen in order to get them past as safe. And she was murdered for whistleblowing on that. They even made a film out of it. Then there are some other examples, really quite shocking examples of what happens when corporations and states do things. This was, anybody heard of the Love Canal disaster? Considered the worst environmental disaster in US history, where, yeah, they buried a whole load of toxic waste in gallon drums, and then in 55-gallon drums, and then built two schools on top of it. So that was Love Canal. Then was Cerveso in 1976. I'll just quickly go through these. This is Bhopal, of course, 1984. Killer carbide at the top, it says. And believe it or not, they are still trying to get justice in 2010. They still haven't got anywhere. The owners of the company fled to the States, where they escaped all prosecution. And still, they're still at large. and of course Chernobyl. So what am I saying here? This is Hungary's Red Sludge. Anybody remember that story? This is an actual, it looks like a fake photo, but it's actually a real photo of what happened in that sludge.
Oh, really? Is it real?
That's a real photo. That's when the sludge went through a forest, and that's what it looked like. And if you can you see the little the diggers, they look like little toys at the bottom. That's, that was the size of the spill. And this is continuing today. Oh, hang on. Something stopped working. Okay. And, yeah, if we get to the next slides, if they work, there's a news item from a chemical company in Italy the locals are protesting against. So this is this situation is just carrying on. The point of this, all this positive history, is back then with these big spills, these big disasters, it was really obvious who the bad guys were. It was the corporations. And it was really obvious why they were doing it. There wasn't any moral ambiguity. There wasn't any doubt who was in the wrong. Now, my point is, that's all changed. Because now the talk isn't about environmental pollution anymore. It's about global warming. And as the focus has changed, I think the narrative has changed along with it. It's broadened out, and in the process it's become reframed. Now, it's everybody's problem, and everybody's part of the problem. Everybody, governments, industry, transport, agriculture, they're all doing, working very hard. That seems to have gone, doesn't it?
No, it completely froze over. So
we did, okay. It's technology, yeah. We'll carry on the old way. So you've got everybody is doing their tokenistic thing now. The governments are doing it. The corporations are doing it. I have a slide on here about the Deepwater Horizon disaster. BP then, at the time of that was going on, they were trying to rebrand themselves as Beyond Petroleum. Do you remember that? Calling them and giving them sort of green logos and things. It was quite ironic. But there were piss takers out there who redid their logo as Beyond Patience and things like that. So, and there was The Guardian recently did a report on in October about the 20 firms that between them are behind a third of global carbon emissions. So, you know, everybody knows that these companies are doing this. And one person who's very clear about tokenism on behalf of the big corporations, on behalf of governments, of course, is Greta Thunberg, who's kind of everybody's white knight, everybody's hero a little bit at the moment, and, you know, quite rightly. And, you know, she made a quite famous speech at the climate conference in New York, where she said, how dare you take away my future? And you could see how passionate she was. It was quite moving. But the sad thing is, even though she accuses them of climate tokenism, even though she's absolutely right, she also knows, and we also know, that they're not going to listen to her. They're going to listen to Donald Trump. They're going to listen to the trade criteria. They're not threatened by her. In fact, you know, they queue up to pat her on the head and tell her how important she is and how they all agree in principle. But they're just going to carry on and run capitalism because that's all they can do. Donald Trump actually said it best. I'm not going to do anything that threatens American US trade. Well, you know, that is what you do, isn't it? When you run capitalism, you protect your trading bloc. So they are inevitably going to commit to tokenistic gestures. Now in this country, the UK is now committed to net zero emissions by 2050. That's, by the way, thanks to Theresa May. Her last parting shot was to just dump this on her successors and then do a runner. I thought that was really hilarious. And now Boris Johnson is basically forced to say, oh yeah, yeah, 2050, yeah, that's what we'll do. Yeah, that's what we'll do. No worries. No explanation of how that's going to occur. But now they've stuck with it. And so this is where I think the narrative that I was talking about before, where before it was corporations versus citizen, now it's been reframed. Because people are recognising you can't stop capitalism doing what it does. You can't stop the corporations, and you can't make the governments do anything. We've heard that governments don't listen to scientists. Governments don't listen to anybody, except at election time.
which I'll mention later. There's an election looming, and suddenly the Tories have allegedly banned fracking right before an election. You know, does that look a bit suspicious or what?
Suspended.
Well, it was already suspended. That was a joke. That fracking place was up the road from me, and they stopped all work in August because they had a 2.9 earthquake, which almost spilled somebody's tea. But that was not happening anyway. And we also have mentioned this morning eco-anxiety. This is a bit of a new thing that people are feeling. So, this is the situation you're in. If you can't do anything about the fact that corporations are making tokenistic efforts, if you can't do anything about the fact that governments are making tokenistic efforts, and if you're suffering from eco-anxiety, and, finally, if you're not actually willing to consider the only real radical alternative that we would suggest, which is get rid of capitalism, you've only really got one option left, personal tokenism. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. So, to reach net zero by 2050, we've been told in numerous newspaper articles, people have to use less transport, eat less red meat, buy fewer clothes, turn their thermostats down. You've all seen these stories, they're everywhere. And some of the predicted privations are becoming more and more stringent as the sort of doom-laden prophecies get more and more extravagant. So you can imagine us all living in igloos at this rate. Now, but having said that, I'm as willing, I think all of us should be as willing as anybody else to do, you know, what we can. I recycle, even though, tokenistically, I know the UK government actually sends half of my recycled stuff to landfill, or else it exports it to Pakistan. I know that because they admit it.
China as well.
No, they don't. China won't have it anymore. They stopped it. So, you know, there's a tokenistic gesture, but it's something, so I do it. I'm a vegetarian, although I actually agree with the vegans, unfortunately, on the dairy industry, so I'm just waiting for better vegan cheese to turn up on the market. I make reasonable efforts. I don't believe in being smug. I believe in making, you know, doing what you can. But telling people to be cold in winter is unreasonable. Telling them to take eco-friendly but unaffordable options is unreasonable. Forcing privations on me while letting the rich do what they like is unreasonable, and it's anti-working class, and it plays into the hands of the right wing. There's a slide on here, if we ever get it back, a news story saying that asthmatics contribute as much to climate carbon footprint as meat eaters. Because I've actually got one of these, Ventolins. The propellant in them allegedly is bad. Anyway, you get the idea. So even if you're an asthmatic, you're guilty. Now, I had some slides, which I don't think we're going to be able to
get. No, we're getting them now.
Okay. Well, there's the BBC have done an energy report. It's quite comprehensive, and I had a few slides from that just to give us a bit of a reality check about where this country is, for example, in the kind of climate. It's at the top. You've gone past it. It's at the top.
Climate talk.
We might get back at the bottom yet. So if we get back to these slides, I'll show you some context. Basically, the point of the slides is that net zero by 2050 wouldn't really make that much difference in the UK. It wouldn't make that much difference to overall global climate. The UK's contribution to global climate carbon emissions is about 1%. So if you divide yourself and 70 million of you into 1%, that's the sort of thing that we're talking about. But this is to say, let's get it in context. It's surprising, actually, that the UK is so low, because it's the fifth largest economy in the world. I just had a second while let's see if I can find the... what's that? Oh, there we go. And, yes,
big lifestyle changes, everybody get on your bike. Asthmatics. Okay, so big as eating meat. I'm glad we got the slide back. You barely did eat it. Okay. So here we go. Consumer of ring, UK accounts for about 1% of global greenhouse emissions. Underneath it, Donald Trump says, I cannot in good conscience support a deal that punishes the United States, which is not. Okay. So that's the real dialogue. This is UK total energy per person. If you have a look at Canada there, and the USA, Germany. Okay, so we're kind of like in the So this energy briefing, I've got a copy of this if you want to email it, or you can probably find it on the BBC site. It's quite pretty comprehensive. I put this in just because a lot of people, I suspect quite a few people in Extinction Rebellion, probably when we got home, got wood burning fires at back in the camp, because it's quite trendy really fast into that, isn't it? The top one here is wood biomass. And it just seems ironic that it's quite a middle class thing to have a wood burning stove at home. Because people think they don't realise it's dirtier than the coal. If you had a wood burning stove on an evening, it's about the equivalent to having 18 juggernauts in your street with their engine on all night. That's about the equivalent of a wood burning stove. People don't realise this, so compared to other countries, but it all goes by population. So even though Canada there, you see that Canada there is really small, it's actually one of the highest per person emitters, but they've got very low population per land area, so that's why they look like that. So those figures are slightly misleading.
And it's very cold there as well, isn't it?
That's true, that's probably why, alright, so here's where we were. That's where we are now. That's where the net zero target is supposed to be by 2050. Extinction Rebellion want us to get there in this country by 2025, but that's like 6 years away. From 2017 to there in 6 years. Well, I leave you to judge whether that's feasible. This is about electric heat pumps. We're being asked, most people in this, you've got central heating, you've got gas central heating. It's very efficient, it's relatively cheap, better than electric systems. This is a heat pump which draws energy from the outlying air or from the ground. It takes quite a long time to heat up, so if you get a sudden cold snap, it just won't work. It also says on here, you might get to see this. I can't see which one it is. It's it heats house but less than most people's comfort level. So this is what we're supposed to go over to. And it will heat your house less than your comfort level. So then you will need additional forms of heating. Okay. Most people are saying that really, in order to get to net zero, there's no option about this. Going to have to do it. This is why Jeremy Corbyn is promising these extensive new subsidies for double glazing and insulation, if they get elected. Not that they will probably do it, and they probably can't. We don't have the money anyway. But this is why it's a big hot, it's a hot button topic in the election, because people know that we're going to have to insulate houses, we're going to have to do a whole ton of things if this 2050 target is not just a pipe dream. Okay. But at the same time, progress in insulating UK houses has actually slowed down, because what they did was the government they cancelled all the legislation in 2008 for new builds because it was depressing the building market, so they couldn't afford to build new houses with the regulations at the time. So the government just cycled back on all the regulations, said okay, you don't have to build houses that are sustainable. So we've actually gone backwards in a way. So much for the a quick view of the context. This is a guy who felt so bad so bad about the state things that he says he's given up a six-figure salary to join the Extinction Rebellion. Well, bully for him that he's got a six-figure salary to give up, that's what I say. But, okay, this is all about... Here's where the narrative has changed. This is where it's become all about you and what you're going to do. He's done that. This bloke has clearly feeling quite bad about things. What did you do during the global warming, Daddy? So he's doing this so that he can look his grandchildren in the eye. You see how the narrative has now become about personal guilt? This is all about making you feel bad. You know, forget the corporations we looked at earlier. Let's not worry too much about them. We can't do anything about that. It's all about eco-anxiety and our right to feel bad about things. And so, of course, this has sparked a bit of a backlash online. People are quite happy to catch out Extinction Rebellion for doing allegedly hypocritical things like queuing up at McDonald's during an XR protest here. So somebody snapped that. What did he do? Veggie burgers in McDonald's? I don't know. This guy's eating the Daily Mail.
Coupons. £1.99 for the meal McDonald's.
Yeah, all right, thank you. Well, thank you for the adverts. The commercials can wait till after. The Mail and the Telegraph reported with glee that this guy, Christopher Hone, KCMG, revealed this month he was the largest individual backer of Extinction Rebellion, having given them £200,000, at the same time as clandestinely building up a 4% stake in Ferrovial, which owns Heathrow Airport. His stake is now worth £630 million. So he's kind of playing both sides in this game, which is kind of amusing. But the backlash continues. Here's a guy. This is Spiked magazine. I think this grew out of one of the communist magazines. I can't remember which one it was.
Living
Marxism, that was it, yeah. So this guy is playing the class card, pulling out these big guns on this one. He's calling Extinction Rebellion an upper middle class death cult, and we should ridicule it out of existence. He says it's a reactionary, regressive, and elitist movement whose aim is to impose the most disturbing form of austerity imaginable on people across the world. This is people in other parts of the world who are what he calls aspirational workers. Aspirational in the sense that they haven't got what we've got and they want to get what we've got, and therefore, you know, and in a sense he's right. I mean, you know, you can't argue that. The Extinction Rebellion thing, as with the environmental movement generally, has tended to be a middle-class thing. That's always been the case. And because it's tended to be a middle-class thing, they've always seen, this is my argument, they've always seen that issues of class are divisive. And really, we've only got one planet. This is Spaceship Earth. We all live on this. We're all inhabited the same. We're all in the same boat, literally, you know, as this. This is an old joke, by the way. I redid. But they don't want to talk about class because they see it as divisive. But if you don't talk about class, you end up with this delusion that we and the bosses and the rich can all somehow work together, you know, to find a common agreement. There is no chance of that. They are the bosses, and we are doing all the workers. And Extinction Rebellion need to wake up to the fact that there is a class aspect to all of this. It isn't just about the... it can't be just a few middle-class people dressing up and doing stunts. That's just pure tokenism. This is my local Whole Food co-op. I did admit earlier I was a vegetarian. I do sometimes go to this co-op. And in the window this week, as we speak, they've got a... I don't know if you can see that. It says, bye-bye, frackers. Ha, ha, ha. So a little bit of smug triumphalism there. This is obviously from this news story, as we mentioned earlier, that fracking has been halted. But it's just been halted just prior to the election. And Business Secretary Andrea Leadsom said that this ban may only be temporary. So, you know, they're leaving their options open. Mm. But what the people advertising in the... there, having a laugh there, what they didn't realise on the same day, this is the 2nd of November, just a few days ago, on the 2nd of November,
the same day, it was reported that just up the road from us in Whitehaven, they're opening the first deep coal mine in decades. So not so much triumphalism on that score. They're stopping fracking for the time being, but they're opening a new coal mine in Whitehaven.
That's a fracking liberty, isn't it?
It is a liberty. So we've got... but actually, I mean, if you look at coal mines, there are coal mines being opened all over the world all the time. There's 52, I think, opened in India this year.
Yeah.
And some have been opened in a dozen or so in America, three big ones in Turkey, a huge one in Australia, I believe. So... that doesn't mean that the coal industry is increasing. It is declining, but they are still opening new seams, various places. It's still a huge industry. So, one of the problems that which is what drives people into this sort of personal tokenistic behaviour, is the inability to do anything about the fact that fossil fuels are being subsidised. And globally, this is an IMF study that says globally they are being subsidised to the tune of $5.2 trillion. So the argument being, if you priced fossil fuels at their actual cost, industry would grind to a halt. You couldn't afford to. So you couldn't run capitalism without subsidising these fossil fuels. And that's what you're up against. In order to keep capitalism running, you have to subsidise the very thing that's destroying the climate. And people, and the sad thing isn't that people don't know this, I think they do know this, and that's why, in a sense of eco-helplessness, people resort to the sort of silly, tokenistic things that we're starting to see. But some people are asking the right questions. I read an article by George Monbiot just the other day, who said, I used to say it was financial capitalism that was the problem. And then I thought it was international mega corporations that were the problem. He said, I realised I was wrong all the time. It's actually just capitalism that's the problem. That's it. There aren't these different types of capitalism. Some are better than others. He said, it's just capitalism that's the problem. That's it. It's taken me all this time to realise. Unfortunately, he didn't then have a suggestion about what to do about it, but at least he was asking the right question. And this is New Scientist from just the other day, two new books that are saying the same thing. Is capitalism the problem or the solution? So they don't have an answer either, but that's where we come in, I think. Thank you. So I don't know if anybody's got a question or anything.
Yeah. Starting off, I think the big question I'd ask is, with token capitalism and the way it's being played out with climate change in terms of doing a little bit here and there, is it in some respects just to soften people's own egos to say they've done something rather than look at the whole situation objectively?
Yeah. Yes. I recently read a paper by an academic. In fact, he works at the university up the road from me. And his paper was widely reported as being so shocking that people were seeking psychotherapy. Jen Bendel, yeah. And in that, he talks about tokenism in terms of what he calls implicative denial. This is the idea that you're denying the fact that you're implicated in what's going on by using this tokenism as a sort of escape. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, I've got central heating, okay, I've got a dog, okay, I've got a car, okay, I eat meat, but I recycle, I do this. So we use this kind of, it's a psychological sort of tool that we use to just deal with a reality that's just kind of intolerable. So it's a trick we play on ourselves. So, that's what I think probably we are doing. Probably all do it, in fact. Yeah.
With global warming comes oceans will rise.
Yeah.
That's when we'll start losing arable land in various parts of the world. Our ability to grow more food to feed the rising populations may be reduced. And also, as you know, like in London and a lot of the world under the capitalist system, there's not enough homes. all these people that will leave the countries that are flooding, and they can't sustain a living there, they can't grow enough food, so they'll have to move. That in itself is going to create huge problems. We only see, I think most people only look at global warming, they don't think of global flooding, you know. And it's a big worry. And I think, is there any truth, perhaps someone can ask, is there any truth in that Trump was seriously thinking about buying Greenland?
Yeah. He did. He floated it.
Or was it sort of false news?
No, I think he did float the idea, and it's been suggested before. Yeah. But Denmark said you can't have it. It belongs to us. People of Greenland are going. Hang on a minute. No.
No, I was thinking that maybe Greenland's melting as well. So maybe he thinks in the long term it's going to, you know, give him more land.
I mean, Glenn will be able to tell you more about this, but I mean, as far as I understand it, global warming, it's not warming at the same rate all around the world, so it's warming up to six times faster in the poles. So it seems fairly obvious that the Greenland's going to turn into a piece of prize real estate. Bill suggested, you know, there are going to be places like Northern Canada and Greenland that the rich are going to settle. And that seems to me pretty likely. Plus, once the ice is gone, you've got a huge new fund of raw materials and rare earth metals and things like that that are all up there.
Well, it's a huge cut. It's a huge
So it's going to be like
it's
the Yukon.
Size of Europe.
It'll be like the. It's not actually. It's about the size of Algeria.
Well, it's big.
When you see it on maps, because of the way the map is spread out, it makes it look much bigger than it is. But it actually just fits into Algeria. Okay. So, but it's still pretty big. You know, Algeria's big. But yeah, it's going to be like a Yukon gold rush. So while we're all drowning down here under 30 feet of water, you know, the rich are going to have a grand old time up there. Yeah. Glenn.
Oh, coming back to Jim's point, I agree. I mean, I think there will be, I suspect, with, you know, rising sea levels, the peoples that live in those parts of the world will begin to, or will want to, migrate away. But there was some research done a good few years back now when I started looking at this environmental stuff up in the Arctic. And some of the world's largest corporations got together to look at the economics of dealing with climate change. And it was clear from this research that their conclusion was such that because of the mainly poor nations in the southern hemisphere aren't that productive, they're also, in terms of contributing towards the economy, they're also the poorest nations. They're also the nations that will suffer most from rising sea levels and the effect of climate change. So economically, it wasn't really worth doing anything about it because they were effectively expendable. Which kind of comes back also to Bill's point that he was saying about billionaires having retreats to go to. And actually, if they can keep control of their armed forces, it'll be all right for them in the end, as it were. Whether we agree with that or not, I don't know, because I mean, they'd be losing a lot of things, obviously. But also in a smaller way, that sort of thing, the way that people actually are just expendable, was demonstrated to a degree in a lighter sense with Extinction Rebellion's protests in the early, where their first protest in London, where it was clear to see, even the media showed this, that the policeman was sort of playing with them, really. You know, one policeman's having it on a skateboard, another one joined him with a bit of juggling or something. And very rapidly, the government didn't like that. And you could see that that then got stopped and quashed pretty smartly. And then they got their new posh riot clearance, yellow vest, and then they steamed into them and they chopped their tents up and everything. So it got much more nasty. That's in this country. I suspect in other countries, they'd shoot them. You know, they wouldn't go around. Mm.
I used to go caving in the limestone areas for many years, and I was always shocked how warm it is. Even if you go maybe 20, 30 feet underground, and it can be minus 10 outside in, you know, Wales or wherever the, you know, limestone areas are, how warm it is. So why aren't we building homes underground rather than on the surface? So if we do enter a new sort of ice age, or if global warming does make the surface hot, if you go underground, you find the temperature is constant all year round.
I
I think we've seen this plot in War of the Worlds, actually, haven't we? Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Okay, just two things. In contention first from this point, it is possible to build underground, but it's a lot more expensive because of drilling and other things as well. But it is entirely possible. But that takes a lot of time. A good example of that would be in something like Montreal in Canada and places like Vancouver, where they have built underneath the city so that they can put homes and other things as well. But these are transit points, not homes. Second point, in regards to what you were saying about with the rich building their bunkers, I've been reading up further about this. There is a more developed plan than just this. This has not been talked about much. Is essentially moving some of the populations that are in LA, like people within IT, for example, manufacturing and other things, and be able to move a lot of those factories north. Because if parts of the United States are going to be prone to flooding, like California and other places, the idea would be, if they have enough time, for the capitalists to move a lot of the manufacturing north. Because, as I said, nowadays, let's say you build a phone can be built in Africa with different components. It might be manufactured in China, but it can all be put together. So what's probably going to happen is there's going to be a lot more population move north. Anything that's considered, as you said, economically south is going to be left to rot. And anyone that does try to get through, if it comes to it, will probably be shot. Mm. So this is where we're heading. Mm. So I'll leave it like that.
I'm just thinking of a story my mum once told me. She once met a squaddie who had his job was to look after a nuclear bunker in case the local dignitaries needed to resort to it in the event of a nuclear war. And she said to him, so you'd get to go in with all these important, ministers, would you, and or council people? And he went, oh, no, they wouldn't let me in. So she said, well, so you're happy to just guard the nuclear bunker for them and then they won't even let you in if there's a nuclear war? And he said, to be honest, I'm not too worried. Just before I shut the door, I'll roll in a couple of grenades.
That's a good one.
So, I don't know. Yeah, that was just in relation to this idea of the rich in their bunkers and would they be able to control their military, you know? Mm. I think that's always an open question, isn't it? Bill?
A couple of things arise when you talk. I live in a house of multiple occupancy, so one of the problems is that means we have to leave the heating on all day because people work night shifts and all this sort of thing. So we can't start being parsimonious with the heating. I probably would turn it down lower than they have it, but that's, in a shared house you can only live the temperature of the person who wants it warmest, really. And likewise in my workplace, they say this is a green thing, but they're quite plain also, it's about saving costs. They're setting offices to 21 degrees and corridor spaces to 16, and this is their first, it's a centrally controlled heating system throughout the building. They're setting it this. And the thing is, it's similar to, this book about the mismeasure of society. Apparently, on average, women prefer temperatures slightly higher than 21. So while I'm fine at 21 and would find it uncomfortable at 23, there's a lot of women who are basically looking wretched around my office on a cold day now, because it's probably about just a bit of heat, maybe about 20 degrees or less. And so in part, it is also becoming a function of where they are saving money by trying to persuade us to accept colder offices and just wear another jumper or something like that. Mm. And I understand, we can just all wear a jumper at home. My dad had one of these chemical thermometers with sort of like ratings on it, and it says at 15 degrees you're at risk of stroke and hypothermia. Not 15 degrees, put a jumper on, because the air going in is colder. Mm. I was there at Hustings one time, and the Green and the Tory were both there trying to conspire to kill my dad. Mm. I said, it's more jumpers and we can just all be a bit colder in winter. So, I mean, it doesn't, as you're right, it doesn't fly. Yes, we could insulate our houses a lot better, and it wouldn't cost much to do it. It would be fairly easy if we set the programme off, but the cost under capitalism is prohibitive now.
Well, it is. I mean, my house is like, it's like falling down. It's an old mill house, and it's a bit of a wreck, and it's just, I can't afford to put new windows in it, so it just leaks heat like a nuclear power station. You know, people come and sort of curl up outside. all the local cats and everybody. I can't afford to do anything. I can't afford to insulate it or do anything to the roof. You know, it's ridiculous. And I have absolutely no faith in Corbyn's government, if he had one, to be able to afford to do all this. Somebody did estimate that you could loft insulate and cavity wall insulate every house in England and Wales for the cost of one nuclear power station. That was about 20 years ago. That was Cumbrians opposed to a radioactive environment, or CORE, as it was called. And they came up with that, but I don't know how true that would be. Anybody else? I'm just wondering when we're supposed to break for, because we know when we're supposed to stop. For.
Now.
Elon Musk is, as far as I can say, he does come up with some really good ideas. One was that every home should have solar cell tiles. So, you know, when you tile a home, there'll be interlocking solar cell tiles. The problem with generating electricity from wind and wave and solar is storage. You've got dams, you've got hydro, electric skin, but you need to store electricity. That is the big problem for the peaks and the troughs. So he invented this great big power pack that basically you put on your wall in your house. Instead of selling it to the National Grid for X amount of money, or they give you, 10 years worth of rent, there's all these different schemes. But every new house had solar cell tiles, a solar cell power bank. It'd be about the size of that window there, and they fit on your wall. You could run quite a lot of things. And because we're using a lot of low-energy things now, Europe said that our Hoovers were too powerful, 2,000 watts and turbos, and now we're all going down to little cordless ones and LED lights. So we're actually using less power. And we could, in fact, almost be self-sufficient in power if we had solar cell tiles on the house, like built in the house from new, with the power banks, perhaps, to store the electricity. And basically, we'd have to use whatever we got. If we go beyond what we got, then that's it.
Okay. Yeah.
Was Mandy?
Should we take a couple more questions and then call it a day? Because we've got, I think lunch is probably getting ready upstairs. I think it's lots of cheese and stuff.
Nice.
Did you want to say?
Mandy first, then after me.
Adam.
Yeah.
Adam, did you have something to say?
No, it's Mandy.
Mandy, sorry. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, because it's kind of relevant, but I read something this week that really I didn't understand, and it's about tokenism, and there's been an article kicking around Facebook and whatnot about how much worse the scientists think it is, the extinction of the human race coming and global warming faster than they thought, and towards the end it had a series of things that this scientist or this reporter thought could happen, was to use less carbon fuel, to eat less meat and take less aeroplanes. But the one that got me was to do with the population boom, which was mentioned earlier, and it was saying that they should keep women in education longer. How does that mean to help?
Oh, no.
There's a strategy.
If we're all too busy swatting, we're not going to want babies.
David Attenborough is involved in a. He's the president of the, I think it's called the Population Society, something like that. They look at population figures, and what they discovered is that areas of the world where the population is increasing, typically they're very often Muslim countries as well, where the women are not allowed contraception, and the other thing that the women are not allowed is education. So education and contraception seem to go together to be key factors in population control. So even in somewhere like India, where you've got some places that where the women are not allowed education and contraception, although it's not Muslim, obviously, the average sort of family size is 3 or 4 children, whereas in Kerala, where they've got 100% literacy, women stay in school as long as the men do, and they have contraception, it's European average. Okay. bearing in mind the European average is for populations to decline. So really, the only place in the world where population is increasing is sub-Saharan Africa, where they can't get contraception because the men control all of that, and they don't, and the women don't have education. So I think that may be the key.
All right, so it's
driver.
Not for the world over.
It's not the world over, no.
Imagine in women in their 50s having to do another degree.
I mean, going to the... this population thing, I think it's a bit of a... It's a pernicious myth, and I've heard it so many times that what we've got to do is, you know, people that I would expect to know better, and that just say, well, we need fewer people. Years and years ago, there used to be a... People used to say you could fit all people in on the planet... Onto the British Isles.
Isle of Wight.
It was the Isle of Wight, okay. Yeah. So a few years back, I thought, I bet that's not still true, you know. So I looked into it and I did a sort of back of the envelope thing, you know. I imagine if everybody's standing with about the density you would in a lift, how many islands would you need? You certainly need more than the Isle of Wight now, but you need a few of the Scottish islands. But that's really about it.
Well, education.
So if you think about the size of the planet and the size of the Isle of Wight and a few people, and then you say to yourself, there's too many people on the planet, you realise what a laughable argument that is. It's not population that's driving climate change. It's capitalism. It's capitalist industrial practices. And the fact that carbon footprint rises with income. So an American has a 20 times the carbon footprint of an Ethiopian. It's not to do with population, it's to do with income, and it's to do with capitalist practices. So, that was a bit of a speech, was it? Anybody else? Or shall we say...
It's me!
Oh, sorry.
Specific question for you, yeah. My darling. I found this term very interesting, tokenism. That's how you say?
Yeah.
Tokenism. I found that really... Because one of my previous kind of concerns about what I call that transition to socialism. Because mm-hmm. there's a kind of... it's kind of natural, you know, sense, and of course, rational as well. So, and then you talk about energy and all that, how you can actually achieve socialism and then avoiding, and that's the point, that's my question. How can you avoid reformism? Because I still got questions about some things. Of course, I would like to be rather, in my views, okay, reform, because some things, it's not that to be changed completely, because you don't know what is it. But then instead of living this kind of magic of tomorrow we're going to have socialism in all countries and all consciousness is all educated, I found that very difficult for simple problems like that. It's like some people don't have access to education, information, or whatever, equalities. So, and I believe that's the only natural process for salvage of the world. Of course, it would be socialism. But my question is, how and why could you not use the accumulation of capital to actually install socialism? Because it's very easy to say, oh, let's kill the devil. And let's live your happy life here on your nice island. And self-sufficiency, another word that don't agree much, because you can be self-sufficient, but definitely gonna in a standard life we are expected to be in a good life, which quality of life, you cannot even from the whole production of a little country. I'm not gonna give examples, but in England, United Kingdom, you cannot actually be self-sufficient. It would be ridiculous thinking you could do that. And it would be ridiculous as well, delete all this money and lands and resource, just abolish and suddenly. And then I really think, what do you think about that? And tokenism, I think, is kind of, that's kind of, I thought it would be working, but you say that doesn't work, because you just kind of say, oh, take it in, shut up, and you're going to still doing reformism. And then you're actually never going to get to the point which is transforming capitalism, potentializing into a change which would be beneficial and more kind. human mercy.
Okay, so yeah, so that's it's a good point. We tend to focus so much on capitalism. The debate is all about getting rid of capitalism. What we need to have is, once that debate is finally over, when we've got rid of capitalism, a whole new debate is going to start up, which is a far more interesting, far more constructive one, which is all about what you just said. And we can start that. We can have that debate now. We can lead it into it now, and we've already done that. I mean, one of the things that we've said in the party loads of times is, you know, people talk about abolishing the state, you know, as if the state is entirely a coercive setup, and we need to get rid of it root and branch. But there are aspects of the state we wouldn't want to get rid of. Think about the health service. Think about emergency services. You know, think about road and distribution networks. There are things that you would want to keep. There are things that you can transform for use in socialism. So we understand that. We're not destroying. The sort of rhetoric about destroying capitalism is just rhetoric for us. It's not about destroying. In fact, I like to look at it a different way, which is it's actually upgrading capitalism. It's upgrading something that doesn't work very well, that was maybe that did achieve quite a lot of advances for the human race, but it's now out of date. It's obsolete. It needs to be upgraded to a much better model. That's what I prefer to argue capitalism is, because it pulls the rug from underneath our opponents who like to point to the achievements that capitalism has made. We can recognise that. We've always recognised that and say, yes, it has achieved quite amazing things. I don't know if you know this. Most people apparently in studies don't know this, but in the last 30 years, global poverty has actually declined from 52% to 21%. This is because of the rise of industrialisation in China and Asia. Most people think that global poverty, this is absolute poverty, by the way, most people think it's gone up, but in fact it's gone down, and most of that has been down the last 15 years or so. So that's a massive decline in global poverty. However, that's not a success story for capitalism, because global inequality has skyrocketed in the same period. So the rich are now the richest people who've ever lived in recorded history, and they are getting richer by orders of magnitude. So that's not a success for capitalism. That's another reason why we need to get rid of it. It is out of control, and it's dysfunctional to the point, like, well, when computers go wrong, you don't think, I hate computers, I want to destroy all computers. You just think, maybe I need to get a better computer, a more modern one. That's what I like to think about socialism. It's an upgrade on an old, out of date, obsolete system that we've got. And that's a positive way of looking at the future.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we'd better stop now, wouldn't we?